Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well. What tips do they have for you and I? And I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. We're up to our last episode for season 3 of the podcast. It's actually our last episode for the year. The team and I will be taking a bit of a break over the summer, or the winter for our Northern Hemisphere listeners, but here in Australia it is our summer break, both to regroup and to have some holiday and rest and relaxation, but also to create some big plans for the podcast for 2019. So we're going to be back in mid-January of 2019 with season 4 and the beginning of a whole new year. And I thought this would be a good opportunity to reflect on what I have learned, not just during the week as I do each week, but over the course of this whole year and my podcasting journey, because we launched with season 1 on the 21st of March 2018. We have produced 30 episodes, 30 interviews with some fantastic guests, amazing guests. And so I thought my reflection today would be things that I've learned from launching a podcast. And the first thing I've learned is that it's a whole lot of fun. It's a huge amount of work, but that is absolutely counterbalanced by how much fun it is and how much I have enjoyed not only the process, but every conversation that I have had and my interactions with you as our lovely listeners. I've learned so much from my guests, not just in terms of the content, and we have covered everything this year from the brain to parenting to stress to acceptance to productivity to balance to hope to schools to identity and, of course, happiness and well-being. And I've learned how generous my guests are, not only with their time and their expertise, but with their personal stories. I've learned a lot about audio recording, what to do and what not to do, as you may have heard from some of my earlier episodes of this season where the technology was not my friend. I've learned a bit about you, our audience, who you are, and that you listen to us when you're running or when you're driving or commuting or preparing the dinner, and that we've been your inspiration for reaching goals or your guidance for being a more confident parent, or your reminder to breathe when things get difficult. I've learned that it costs a lot to produce a podcast. I ran the numbers recently and I won't tell you exactly what I've invested in this show this year, but it starts with a 10 and ends in a 1,000. And of course, I don't regret a single cent of it because it has been a joy, but it has given me pause to reflect that maybe I need to take a look at how I fund this into 2019, especially as I'm keen for the show to continue to grow and to improve. And finally, and there's been lots of other learnings in there, you know, a heap of things, but finally, I've learned a lot about myself creating this podcast this year. It was a goal that I set myself and a goal that I have achieved, not only to launch it, but to sustain it throughout the year. And I've learned that I love being a bit of a sticky beak and asking people questions about their work and their research and their jobs and their clients and their passions and their expertise. I've learned, I think, that I have a bit of a knack for that question asking. That's certainly how it feels from this end, and I hope that's how it comes across from your perspective as you're listening in. I've learned how great it is to work as part of a team producing this podcast each week. Ordinarily, I do work on my own, but this has been very much a team exercise, and I'm enormously grateful to my audio producer, Andy Marr, for his help and for everything that I've learned from him so far, and I know I've got a lot more to learn, so thank you, Andy. And a big thanks go to my right-hand woman, Jay. She is my editorial assistant, and she is forever teaching me how to be more organized and more efficient. So it has been a big year and I have learned a lot, and I hope that you have learned something too, because that is our goal here at the Potential Psychology Podcast, to help you to live, learn and flourish. But we haven't finished yet. We have one final guest for this season, and today we're going to learn a little bit about how to manage work and stress and tech and email. So let me introduce you to our guest for this week. Joining me today is Dr. Melissa Marotte, an organizational psychologist and clinical neuropsychologist whose key interests are life and work transitions, developing potential, emotional intelligence, burnout, stress, and managing the complex nature of work and life. Melissa's based in Melbourne, where she works as a consultant psychologist with a number of organisations, including our friends at the Mind Room in Collingwood. She's also a faculty member at the School of Life, where she delivers a number of programs centred on emotional intelligence. And Melissa is a dog trainer in her spare time. And today, among perhaps some other topics, Melissa and I are talking about our psychological needs at work and how we can best manage ourselves and our stress levels to avoid burnout. Welcome, Melissa.
Hello, it's very nice to be here today.
It's lovely to have you here, because you and I have lots of things in common related to workplaces and well-being. So it's a great opportunity to have a good chat about those things. But I wanted to ask you first, because I don't think this is one that we've come across or addressed yet on the Potential Psychology Podcast. What is a clinical neuropsychologist?
Yeah, often when I introduce myself as a clinical neuropsychologist, people look at me and say, what on earth does that mean? So I suppose in terms of clinical neuropsychology, if we start to kind of think of what the words mean, is that I look at the neuroscientific aspects and the neurological aspects of the brain. So as a clinical neuropsychologist, I've worked with individuals who've suffered from head injury, from stroke, epilepsy, neurodegenerative disorders, dementia, elements of that, anything that affects our brain organically and how that in turn affects our life and the way that we work through life. So in terms of my broader interests in psychology, it really brings a lot of understanding around the neurosciences and how that affects affects our approach to life and work.
So getting a better understanding then of the behavior, which I suppose is kind of the core of what psychology is, but what's happening in the brain that's underlying the behavior. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we think about things like stress and the stress response, you know, what's sitting behind that? What happens from the hormonal level? What happens from the neurological level? And how we experience stress, you know, how we physiologically, you know, our body experiences stress, how our brain experiences stress, and then in turn, how we can better manage it.
Beautiful. I did developmental neuropsych as one of my subjects at university many, many years ago. And I loved it. I really enjoyed it, but didn't pursue the area. But yeah, fascinated in that brain side of things. So I will quiz you a little bit on that then, for my benefit and the benefit of our lovely listeners. So how best do you describe, because that's quite different to perhaps what most people think of as organizational psychology and working with teams and workplaces. How do they fit together for you? How do you describe what you do?
Yeah, I'm one of those unusual folks that have this combination. There certainly aren't many of us around that have this combination of neuropsychology and organizational psychology. I suppose it's fixed to my broader interest of who we are as human beings and our human condition in this life on earth, as it were. And part of our human condition is our brain. So that's something that really interested me. And I suppose in terms of more recent research, we're starting to get a better understanding as to how our brain and how the neuroscientific aspect does work in with us as social beings, you know, in the way that we interact with each other. And the world of work for me is essentially just, you know, how we are as a group, how we are as social beings and how we interact with each other. So it's kind of interesting from that perspective, you know, in terms of when we look at the stress response, for example, we talk a lot about the lizard brain or the limbic system. And we also talk about how limbic systems talk to each other and bypass the more kind of higher level kind of language functions, even, you know, in terms of how we're. That's it. The more rational bits, it kind of bypasses a big time. So I find those kinds of aspects interesting, and that's where it tends to cross over and interrelate.
Okay. So can you explain for us then, because we are going to talk a bit about work and stress because they're experiences that we all have, no matter where you work. And of course, stress extends across our entire existence, not just in our workplace. Can you explain then a little bit of the neurobiology, perhaps, of what's going on in all of those systems that you mentioned when we get stressed?
Well, I suppose in terms of that stress response, you know, when we get stressed, let's kind of think about a situation that, you know, a bunch of us kind of come across a number of times, is that person that has sent us loads of emails has sent us another email and really wants us to kind of finish something up before 5 o'clock today. And we're getting a bit annoyed with this person and irritated with this person. And we're really tempted to, you know, fire an email back again straight away. But it's probably better just to put it in the drafts inbox for a little while before we fire it back. So if we did kind of fire back that email, and if we were tempted to wander over to that person and say, oi, you know, hang on, why are you sending me that email? I've said that I can't do it by today and I can only do it by tomorrow. And straight away our stress response kicks in. So what is that stress response from that neurophysiological perspective? We might feel that our heart rate is increasing. We might feel that we're, you know, running a bit short of breath. We might feel that our palms are a little bit sweaty, you know. You might even start to feel that we're shaking a little bit when we're wanting to approach that person, and we might feel a little bit overwhelmed with that. We might feel really angry, irritated. So these are our more, how would you say, fundamental kind of functions of our brain that are kicking in, that are saying, look, there's some kind of difficulty or danger here and I need to deal with it right now, and I need to sort it out right now because this deals with my survival. It's kind of like an evolutionary response and probably a little bit out of proportion as to what's required to manage that email, but it does kick in nevertheless. And so if we wander over to that person and start to talk with them in that way, you know, kind of like irritated, angry, annoyed, kind of heightened in our responses, we would say in the world of neuropsychology, is that person might respond in the same way. So then all of a sudden we've got our limbic systems talking with each other and the rational parts kind of disappear.
So that's the point at which there might be some shouting, some perhaps, well, I was going to say unpleasant language, but certainly unhelpful language.
Unhelpful language.
Changed.
Yeah, levels of irritation, annoyance, and probably kind of, you know, bad feeling.
Okay, so it's a process that, as you say, so about survival, it's a historical, you know, it's kind of core to who we are as human beings. And I like the way you said that it overrides perhaps some of the more rational parts of our brain or our thinking. Is that right?
Yeah, it tends to bypass it. So there might be a little rational voice inside our heads that are saying, hang on, maybe you shouldn't go over to, you know, such and such person, but I don't care, says the other part of our brain. It says, I'm going anyway because I need to sort this out right now. So it kind of bypasses it, and that little voice might be there, and you might kind of reflect, you know, a day or two later thinking, I probably should have listened to that voice. But yeah, it does bypass, and it does, it is very insistent as a loud voice, that part of our brain that wants to make sure that we survive and kind of live through this situation as an evolutionary response.
So that's what's happening, and we can sort of understand, I think that really gives us a sense of what's occurring at some of those deeper levels within our behaviour, those bits that we really don't necessarily have a huge amount of control over, those emotional responses.
Yeah.
What do we do about it? Because we kind of know that we're not necessarily setting ourselves up for success if we continue to listen to those voices and respond in that way, particularly at work.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a really great point. And I suppose the tough thing about these responses is that they're instantaneous. They just happen. And we have no control over that, is that these things just happen. Our heart rate increases and we have no control over that. Our breathing might become more shallow and become faster. We might get sweaty palms. We might even feel a little bit red-faced. You know, our face might go a little bit red and we have no control over that. So to try and manage control over that is, you know, kind of super hard. But what we can do is that we can kind of take time out, as I call it, you know, take a moment break. Know that that's happening to us, and then having a choice in terms of how we respond to that. And so if we start to build some insight and kind of awareness, you know, noticing when these things happen, then that's a really good thing to do. If we notice that we're getting more irritated and angry, if we notice that we're starting to, you know, our heart rate is starting to increase, and we can start to build the ability to choose how to respond to that rather than kind of running over to that person who sent the email.
So understanding what's going on, paying attention to what's going on. Then are there kind of simple things that we can do? You talk about time out, which, of course, for me as a parent, imagines me putting myself in the corner. Is it sort of counting to 10, or is it, or what kind of works have you found when helping others to understand this process?
I mean, I suppose timeout is a bit of a psychological timeout, just a kind of taking a psychological breath. So, an emotional breath, as it were. So some of the techniques we talk about is, we use a lot of mindfulness type of strategies, and there's a whole bunch of stuff out there that people can explore around mindfulness. But sometimes timeout can literally mean just taking a few breaths, giving us that moment of, allowing that emotional response of anger or irritation or faster heart rate to come and go, because it can go just as quickly as it comes along as well. So giving ourselves a bit of emotional timeout so we can watch it come and go. So another way that I like to talk about it is kind of like giving it a bit of arm's length so we can see it, we can look at it rising and falling. So taking a breath, there are a few kind of active strategies that we can take if we're able to. Take a walk around the block, for example, if we need to, which is a very practical timeout.
Yep.
Putting that email in the drafts box rather than sending it straight away, coming back to it later in the day, coming back to it the next day. If it's a really difficult and complicated situation, see if you can call a friend. That's always helpful too. Just check in with someone else. And it's basically giving an opportunity for the rational part of our brain to kind of get in on the action and get activated again and have a stronger voice.
So just allowing that. I like that idea of just understanding that these sort of almost like waves come, but they will disappear again as long as you give it time. So a bit of a pause in there before you take action. So a pause between the feeling and the action, maybe.
And whatever works for people, and thinking about what that pause might be.
Yeah.
For some people, it's making a cup of tea. That could be helpful.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is obviously something that applies at work, but across all the other parts of, for me, parenting, perhaps when something happens and you find yourself getting really riled up very quickly, as happens at home sometimes, interactions with family members, particularly if you've got a past history of difficult relationship with that family member. Sometimes we have people in our lives who just know how to push those buttons and we react. So a sensible strategy for all of those domains.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Melissa, I know that you particularly enjoy working with organisations, workplaces, which are quite a high pressure, situation or scenario. So the emergency services, for example, new startup organisations. What is it that makes them, A, so interesting to you, and B, where we can sort of apply some of this stuff that we're talking about?
I suppose in those kinds of organizations is that they tend to be quite complex and really fast moving. So things need to be done really, really quickly and people need to respond to things really quickly. But also importantly is that the consequences are often quite high. If we think about emergency services or international aid, the way that you respond and react, the consequences are quite high and they can be quite immediate as well. So I do find that really, really interesting and important area to work in. With startups, very fast moving. So consequences, sure, they can be high, very different to emergency services types of consequences, but nevertheless, very fast moving.
And so what is it about a fast moving environment that places us under pressure, I suppose, as individuals?
Yeah, I was kind of thinking about that earlier today, and the big thing that came up for me is reflecting on what the world of work was like, say 20 years ago. I mean, I remember a time when we didn't have answering machines.
Yep.
When someone called you, either you were there or you weren't. Simple as that. And they would wait for you to get back to them if they left a message.
Yeah.
People contacted you by post, by snail mail.
Mm.
So things were slower in terms of communication. Things were slower in terms of people's expectations around communication. The amount of information that was available was, it was still there, but it took time to track it down. So it allowed us time to process it and think about it and how to put it together. So I suppose the two things that really kind of come up for me in terms of fast-moving organizations is communication and information. and then having to respond to that kind of stuff. So say, for example, you know, I've got a bunch of clients that work in startup IT sector, and they'll have Slack on their laptops, they'll have Messenger, they'll have text messages, they'll have emails, they'll have all sorts of ways of people contacting them. So, you know, I hear a number of stories where someone tries to contact them by Slack and then by Messenger. If they haven't responded within 10 seconds, they'll get a text message. If they haven't responded within another, you know, minute or two, they'll get another email. And then if they haven't responded within 5-10 minutes, then someone will walk over and ask them that question. So being bombarded from kind of loads of different places through our, you know, fantastic devices and ways of communicating can be really, really tough. And sure, it's a wonderful way of working. I mean, it's really given us a load of opportunities in being able to get things done, but I think it's also had its consequences.
So technology is our friend, but not always our friend. And I'm guessing it's not so much the technology itself. The technology is a tool, but perhaps, as you're saying, our expectations around this, that for some reason, because we can stay in pretty constant contact with people across the globe 24 hours a day, that our expectations of them and of our access to information has kind of really, it's out there compared to even 10 years ago, maybe.
Yeah, even 5 years ago, I think it's really shifted. Even 5 years ago, you know, even a few years ago, it's shifted a lot. I mean, I work with folks that work across, you know, multiple time zones. So they'll have a meeting at 10 o'clock. They'll be getting their emails at 2 o'clock in the morning to respond to urgent issues. And then I'll be up again at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning to start their workday. So it's literally being on 24/7, and there is an expectation that they're on 24/7. But I kind of wonder in my kind of question around this kind of stuff is how much influence do we have in setting other people's expectations on our time? So I often talk a lot about boundaries and how do we set these boundaries and how do we train others around what they can expect from us as well. Because if we're constantly on, then other people will think, hey, you know, you're constantly on. I'll fire off a question and you'll get back to me.
Yeah. Well, because you're right. We can't change what other people think or do or the way in which they behave, but we can set some boundaries up for what we respond to and how we respond. And particularly as you were just talking then about, you know, these people getting emails and responding to emails and all of that kind of stuff happening 24/7, that has huge implications for our sleep, which is obviously core to our psychological well-being.
Yep, absolutely.
So what are your kind of simple tips, if there are in fact simple tips, nothing simple about human behaviour, but some of your strategies that you recommend or suggest to people around creating those boundaries?
Yeah, I tend to be really practical with these kinds of things, and practical is key. I mean, say, for example, over in the Netherlands, there are some companies that literally turn off their server at 7 o'clock. PM. So no one can communicate after 7 PM in their company. So that's a company-wide thing. But, you know, when many of us aren't lucky in that way is that we don't have our company that turns off the server at 7 o'clock. So we can't work after that point. So kind of setting our own boundaries and setting our own boundaries in terms of where does our laptop and where do our smart devices live when we come home? Does it live on the kitchen table? Does it live on the dining room table? Does it live in our bedroom? Or do we kind of put it somewhere, put it away somewhere so it can go to sleep for a bit and not come back into our sphere of kind of awareness or attention? And we all know how good smart devices are at grabbing our attention with the notifications and the blings and the noises and even just that sense of, I better just check it in case something important has come through.
That's the interesting pieces. There's two things again that come to mind. One, I've been trying to implement this myself because I became aware that my habits, you know, when you work for yourself, there's automatically kind of a blurring between home life and work life, as you know. So trying to implement, I've put screen time, which I think is the latest iOS update for Apple phones. So trying to use that, except that I do find myself still checking it and just going, just remind me in 15 minutes, which is bad. But at least there's an extra step now that I have to go through. And one thing that I did do, could be the better part of a year ago now, I think, is stop having my phone in the bedroom
because I found that if I did wake in the night and sort of found myself having trouble getting back to sleep, I would pick up the phone and do things. And I realized that was not, you know, when I one day I lost about an hour and a half going down a Twitter rabbit hole and then realizing that there's no way I'm ever going to get back to sleep with that. Exactly. And it's made a huge difference. I really have found that it's made a big difference to me and to my sleep and just some habits around that. So there's practical things we can do. But one of the things, because I know I've spoken to a lot of my clients in workplaces about this as well, and they kind of know, I can not use my email. I won't check my work email, or I won't open my laptop. And they kind of set these rules. But we operate in these complex systems where there's kind of unwritten, unspoken expectations of how we respond, or even just in our own mind, a perception that if I'm not totally on top of my email at night, then I'm going to start behind the eight ball tomorrow, or people are going to expect things from me. And how do we deal with some of those more psychological elements of it?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And they tend to be the harder ones to manage and deal with, especially if we're running our own businesses, because it's very difficult to kind of delegate and say, hey, you know, someone else can take this on for me for a little while now. So there's some particular strategies that we can kind of use, and something that I like to talk about is decompression, you know, decompressing from work time and decompressing from thinking about work time and then kind of shifting into non-work time.
Okay.
And knowing that that's an important boundary. So what can we do in terms of decompression? So having an activity, something intentional, something active to separate work time from non-work time. So you might say, I'm going to finish work, even though I might work at from home, I might finish work at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock if it's get really, really tough. So at 7 o'clock, I'll do something that's a decompression activity. I'll do something active in terms of relaxation, whether it's go for a walk around the block, you know, take the dog for a walk around the block, hang out with the kids, you know, hang out with your partner, do some gardening, do all these kind of active strategies, and be really clear that you're starting to head into your own time. So thinking about these boundaries in active ways can be really, really helpful.
It's a little like that pause we were talking about before, isn't it? Yeah. Creating a bit of a pause between my work, busy work brain, and then leading into a hopefully more relaxed brain ready for sleep.
Yep. And that's a really important habit to get into. I find that these things tend to be quite habitual. If we don't set up something that's regular and habitual, then it's really hard to do because in essence, as human beings, you know, we like routine and we tend to respond well to routine. Yeah. So if we can set up a healthy routine for ourselves, and that'll be different for different people. So it's, you know, really hard for me to say, well, you know, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, whatever it is, you know, stop for dinner, don't come back to emails later again. Some people might need to. It really depends on your own routine. Mm. But setting up a routine is an important thing.
So I like that point about it being intentional.
Mm.
So actually being thoughtful and planful in how we manage our day, because you're right, so much, and especially with things that just keep going ping at you, and you know, if you just allow it, your brain will just keep going, just keep going. And we know from a well-being point of view that that's not helpful. So I love that idea of just, you know, actually being intentional about I intend to create a pause or a break between my work day and then the rest of my life, the rest of my day.
And kind of reflecting on our earlier conversation around the stress response, you know, what tends to happen when we want to have a look at that email is that our stress response is kicking in, saying this is going to be really important for my survival, for my business survival, for my family survival, to keep a roof over my head and food on the table. So I have to look at that email. I must.
Yep.
I must look at that Twitter account. I must look at Facebook. I must look at LinkedIn. I don't know if
something important might be happening.
Exactly. So it's that part of our brains that's responding to that. So again, having a choice, you know, building that possibility for choice. Do I respond to that, or do I start to build something else intentionally?
Oh, lovely. So that awareness again, that is, you know, it's almost a part of our brain that we can't control, that sense of urgency or that sense of, you know, as you say, survival, I must, which applies whether that's, you know, we're working for ourselves or working in organizations, because they have that sense of career survival. You know, what happens if my boss has emailed me something and I need to know and I need to respond? Understanding that awareness that those thoughts will kick in without our conscious control, but we do have some control if we create those pauses.
Yeah.
one of the issues that comes up a lot for the people that I work with is, particularly people working in large organizations, is email. And we talked about the pings and the notifications and all of that, but just the sheer quantity of email and managing that information coming in. Is this something that you talk to people about? Have you got tips and strategies for how they can better handle email?
Yeah, that's, I think that's the $60 million question in terms of managing emails. And, in my experience, there's a lot of trial and error in terms of how to manage email effectively. And I find it really depends on the nature of the work that you do and the nature of organization that you work in. There will be some emails and some topics that are more urgent than others and some less so. So I suppose that kind of gives us some clues in terms of how to manage email effectively. There are some good kind of hygiene practices that, you know, we kind of talk about in terms of how to set up email practices with your colleagues and have an agreement about it. But if it's important, then I'll email it to you. If it's something that's of an FYI or for your information, I'll put you in as a CC, but you don't have to respond. So setting up those kinds of practices can be really, really helpful. And you can do that yourself as working in with your colleagues. So that's one area, I suppose. And that's about having a conversation with the people that you work with. So that's within your sphere of influence and control, but there's a whole bunch of emails that come in that aren't within your sphere of influence and control. So how do we then manage that kind of stuff? So then thinking about, you know, what's urgent. So classic kind of divisions of what's urgent, what needs to be got back to immediately, what's important, that needs to be gotten back to, and knowing about the time frame of managing that email, and then what's something that's medium term or long term, and putting them into those kinds of boxes can be really, really helpful.
Okay.
As we scan through our emails.
What I suppose it is about the expectations that we talked about earlier with the communication, so setting up some expectations. And I'm wondering whether that's something that can be done even organization, what, you know, it comes to mind that can be part of the culture of the organization, the conversations we have with each other, the tone that we set if we're a leader in an organization around, you know, this is what works for us, what we know is important, but also we need to remember that your well-being is important. And if you're spending, you know, 3 hours until 1 a.m. just trying to keep on top of the email every night, then that's going to start to impinge on all of those things that we know are vital to well-being, like sleep and relationships and hobbies and other activities. So expectations, leaders' roles in setting those expectations maybe. And then conversations, that's what's interesting, because one of the things about email is we seem to use it to kind of avoid having conversations in many cases.
Yeah. And that's something that was kind of popping up for me at the back of my mind as you were talking about leaders and how they can work through this in a better way and setting up expectations, is that loads of times nowadays we email rather than picking up the phone or walking over and saying hello. And there are loads of things that can be much more efficiently and much more effectively dealt with by having a conversation.
Absolutely. And then there isn't that email that sits there in the box and raises our stress level as we look at the 242 unread email alert.
I see that. Red.
So some interesting stuff there about cultural stuff in workplaces. And, you know, we talk about leaders having a role in that, but even if you are an individual, perhaps managing a team of three people, you can have that conversation between you about, you know, the role of email for us, what's important and how we might prefer to interact as a group.
Yeah.
And so, Melissa, I'm interested. We talk a bit about communication and expectations and email and the, you know, the bits and pieces that make life at work particularly busy. What does this do for our resilience? Where does resilience come into this?
Resilience kind of is an interesting word. We've been using resilience for a very long time and thinking about what resilience actually is. And sometimes when I think about resilience, it's a little bit like, it's a word where we have a kind of a common understanding of what it might mean, but we don't really think about the details enough. So that's my initial kind of thinking about, you know, resilience. What effect does it have on our resilience? It's a little bit like the old words of, you know, strategic thinking. Everyone must be strategically thinking. But what does it actually mean? What does it look like in my work and what I do on a day-to-day basis? And when I think about resilience, it's kind of the same. So what effect does this have on our resilience? And I think it wears away our resilience. it starts to chip away at the edges of our resilience if our communication and emails, you know, aren't being dealt with well, and we're feeling stress about them, is that that feeling of stress and that level of stress, even if it's low level stress, will start to chip away at our resilience.
So if we're thinking about resilience as just that kind of ability to bounce back when things do get difficult, because they do always get difficult one way or the other, and things might be swimming along nicely at work, but something happens at home that kind of knocks us around a bit, or vice versa. It's about having these better habits perhaps at work in order to keep ourselves more robust. Would that be a good way to explain it?
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting. Yeah, I think that's a robustness is a really nice way of describing it and explaining it. But sometimes we don't feel like we're kind of bouncing back when we're being resilient. Sometimes we feel like we're bouncing sideways, bouncing forwards. Sometimes if we kind of use the basketball analogy, we kind of feel like we're just dribbling along. But and we can still be resilient in those times as well. So we don't have to feel like we're having that kind of stoic robustness all of the time, because that, I think, sets up an unrealistic expectation for ourselves in terms of resilience as well. So sometimes we are bouncing sideways. Sometimes we are bouncing forward. Sometimes we're, you know, not bouncing much at all. But knowing how to work through that in a flexible and adaptive way is a useful thing to do, and thinking about those good habits that can carry us through the tough times as well is a really great way of thinking about it.
So just not getting flattened, perhaps.
Not getting flattened, perhaps. Absolutely. If we do, then how do we pump up the ball again?
Just to keep going. And can you describe for me burnout? Because that was one of the other, we talked a bit about stress, but burnout, again, one of those terms that get used a lot, I think, particularly on organisational setting, and you'll see lots of, you know, media articles in the business press about, you know, burnout and avoiding burnout, and this happened and this happened. What is it from a psychological point of view?
Yeah, and that's, it's an interesting one, burnout as well. It's a really good question. And with burnout, I suppose from the psychological point of view, there are two elements that come up for me immediately, and that's from the physical perspective. You know, are we have we got physical symptoms, and do we have emotional symptoms? You know, what happens from that emotional perspective? So from the emotional perspective, are we feeling more exhausted, angry, irritable, tired? Are we finding things more overwhelming, difficult? Do we feel like we're not being as effective? Do we feel like we're not coping as well? And this is kind of like a continuum. It can come in on the, you know, small kind of insidious bit by bit, you know, step by step kind of mode to something that's quite noticeable and quite obvious. From the physical perspective, you know, what's happening with our sleep, what's happening with our appetite, what's happening with our skin, for example. You know, some people experience changes in their skin. Some people experience changes in their hair. So from the physical perspective, a whole bunch of different things happen too.
And I'm interested in this notion that it can be an incremental experience because, you know, that kind of boiling the frog analogy comes to mind a little bit, that we put the frog in water and turn the heat up and it doesn't realize, because I know talking to people that I've worked with, and they report all sorts of signs and symptoms that to me as an outsider go, oh, I don't think you're traveling very well, but for them it's almost become the norm.
Yeah.
So what's the best way to kind of pick up on those things, or how do we handle that situation where we've been living it for so long that we haven't noticed that there's been a change?
Yeah. And that's a really hard thing to do, you know, noticing what's happening for us when we can't see it. It's often other people that tell us that something's going on. Mm-hmm. So what I tend to hear is someone will say, yeah, I'm feeling, you know, more flat or depressed. You know, I'm not as enthusiastic about life and my work. And I'm kind of feeling like I'm losing a bit of meaning and purpose. And I don't know why I'm doing this. And I don't know how it's really helping me. Or I'm feeling really anxious and overwhelmed. You know, these feelings of anxiety are there. I'm starting to feel a bit of panic attacks, for example. So when we start to see these kinds of things, which are, you know, a bit more noticeable and more obvious, then it can be a sure sign that we might be experiencing burnout. I mean, ideally, it would be really great to catch it beforehand, before we get to that point.
That's the thing, isn't it? I know that when I talk a lot about well-being at work, it is the view to be able to tell people, look, just notice when this happens. Notice the first thing so that you don't end up being the boiled frog.
Yeah.
And one of the things that, and I don't know if this is your experience, but what struck me when you were talking then is about, you know, we start asking ourselves questions. Do I really enjoy this? Am I really, you know, getting what I'm supposed to out of this? Is this the job for me? And I do get the feeling that perhaps when people are feeling burnt out, they're starting to look around. They think maybe this isn't the right job for me. There's a better job out there, or I just need to change jobs and it will change for me. Is that a common response to burnout?
It does tend to be, in my experience. It's one of the responses. Yeah, absolutely. When people are asking those soul-searching questions and they're feeling a bit lost, you know, disoriented and not quite sure what they're doing, you know, these questions do come up. And you get some really kind of, you know, you get some interesting thoughts in that, sure, you know, I might be working in the legal profession or as a medico, but maybe I want to be a landscape gardener. Maybe that's what I really want to do. So
something that feels less stressful somehow.
Something totally less stressful, you know, that the opposite end, or a dog trainer, for example. Maybe that's my calling, yeah? These kinds of things start to pop up. And when we notice those things, then they can be some pretty good indicators that we might be experiencing burnout. The things that we have found exciting and that really kind of fired up our enthusiasm and energy about the work is dropping away.
And what do people do in that situation? If we've got listeners who are sort of going, oh my God, that sounds like me, what should they be doing? What's the first step?
Well, I'm a little bit biased. I think the psychologists are pretty good. So having a chat to a psychologist can be really, really helpful.
Our listeners are very used to this bias.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean, you know, it can be a chat of, you know, one or two sessions. It doesn't have to be loads of sessions. It can be just checking with someone who's a professional and saying, hey, you know, maybe you are experiencing burnout. And here are some things that, you know, you can start to build up and things that you can do about it. That's a good thing to do. Checking in with, you know, friends or family or trusted colleagues can be a good thing to do as well. And, you know, asking those questions and seeking that support and help.
So just getting it a little bit out of your head perhaps and having a conversation with somebody else.
Yeah. And talking about it can start to, you know, once we're able to talk about it, we're able to, you know, as you mentioned, get it out of our head and start to see it at arm's length and start to see it ourselves in terms of what's going on. And then we feel we're in a better place to be able to do something about it. And I think trusting our own instincts at that point can be really helpful too, is that I think in my experience, you know, we tend to get more surprised as time goes on about how much we do actually know and what we actually can do ourselves about this kind of stuff, if we can see it clearly. And so part of the challenge is to be able to see it and describe it and notice it.
Step away. And I think that is the power. Certainly, even in the coaching work that I do, a lot of people report that even just talking it through with somebody gives them that bit of distance or that bit of perspective on it. And they'll kind of go, oh, wow, that was amazing. I'm like, well, I didn't really do anything much. You just told me stuff and suddenly stuff made sense.
Yeah, exactly. And then they start thinking about, hey, you know, I experienced this once before and this is how I dealt with it and this is how it worked really well. This is how it didn't work well, so I won't do that again. But this is how it worked really well, and start to get a sense of, you know, their own sense of agency and feeling more empowered in being able to do something in the situation.
And that can be a big first step, isn't it? Just feeling that it's not hopeless.
Yeah.
I think too, for a lot of people, for people listening, you know, most organisations now, even the smaller organisations, and I'm living and working in a regional area, have employee assistance programs that give them access to, if it's over the phone or face-to-face, you know, sessions with a psychologist. And I think for a lot of people, that sounds a bit kind of scary. It's like, oh no, there's nothing wrong with me. I don't need to go and see a psychologist. But using those sessions just as that kind of bit of a brain dump to somebody who's completely uninvolved, completely impartial, who might be able to give you some tips and strategies. And as you say, you might only need to do that once or twice and it, you know, things become clearer and a little more hopeful.
Yeah, I think that's a really great first port of call. And often we do think, hey, you know, do I really want to see a psychologist because there's something wrong with me? I mean, what I think about in terms of these kinds of sessions is figuring out what's right with me as well, you know, what's working well, because that's the kind of stuff that we tend to forget when we're feeling stressed and burnt out, is that we tend to focus on what's wrong, what's not working, what's really tough and what's hard. And again, that's part of our, you know, response as human beings. It's an evolutionary response, is that something's wrong, so we want to fix it and we want to figure it out. But part of that figuring out is seeing what's working well, what's going right, what are the strengths, what are the positive things that we can lean on and start to leverage that we've totally forgotten about, that we can start to, you know, bring to life again in our lives. And speaking to a psychologist or someone that we feel supported by can be a really great first step in finding that out and rediscovering it.
Yeah, all that fabulous strengths-based stuff, isn't it? What am I good at? What do I enjoy? What lights my fire and gets me going and inspires and motivates me? I know our brain does that horrible thing of sending us down problem-focused rabbit warrens, doesn't it? It says, here's a problem. Focus on the problem. Here's the problem, rather than saying, hey, actually, maybe there's a solution. Maybe there's a different way of looking at this.
That's it.
Melissa, can you tell me a bit about this idea of organizational health? We've talked a lot about individuals and even small teams, but what is organizational health?
It's a huge topic.
I know. Here, you've got about 3 minutes.
Yeah, 3 minutes on organizational health.
Perhaps a little flavor and we could have another conversation on another day.
Yeah, I'm thinking, yeah, podcast on organizational health would be really cool. So organizational health, I suppose if we're kind of relating it to well-being and people in the organization, it's really thinking about a culture for health and well-being, a climate for health and well-being across the organization that's supported by leadership, that's supported by systems and processes, that's supported by HR, for example, human resources, and something that's focused on and kind of considers the value of well-being of people in the organization and how it directly relates to performance and organizational effectiveness.
So getting it or adding that piece, I suppose, into the bigger puzzle of what makes an organization, you know, we need to look at the bottom line, we need to look at productivity, we need to look at our systems and our processes, but we also need to look at the well-being of everyone within our system in order to keep it ticking along.
Yeah, because we've talked a lot about engagement in organizations. How do we engage people? How do we bring people along with us? You know, so they're part of the same values and part of the same meaning and purpose and mission statements of the organization. But sometimes that engagement push can forget about how do we then help people to disengage and decompress and look after their own well-being, because that can help engagement when they're working in the organization and engaging in the organization. So we can't have 24/7 engagement, and that's part of the problem when, you know, with the folks that I work with, say, for example, that work across multinationals, is that they are engaged 24/7 at 2 o'clock in the morning, responding to those emails. Mm. So engagement balanced with well-being. So when I think about organizational health, it's thinking about those two aspects.
Okay. And getting that work. I still haven't found a good way to describe what we kind of mean by work-life balance. It's not a balance. I tend to blend, got the right blend between work and then even the life aspect of it. It's like, well, you know, work kind of is life as well. So, I think there's some improvement in terminology that perhaps is required, but I like that idea of the decompression that, we can be very switched on and engaged at work, but we also need to decompress and get away from that in order to stay really well, because they do balance each other out.
Yeah. And so I suppose, I totally agree with the work-life balance definition. It's not a seesaw. When work goes up, life goes down and vice versa. I kind of see it as a bunch of circles or bubbles that are pressing against each other. So there's a bubble with work, or profession or career or vocation, however we want to describe it. There's a bubble around family and friends. There's a bubble around hobbies. There's a bubble around just staring at the clouds time, if we can manage it. Mm. So there's all these different bubbles that are vying for space in this big circle called life. We have 24 hours in the day, 7 days in the week, and certain number of days in the year. So how those different elements then jostle and vie for position is an interesting way of thinking about how these things work together and integrate. So with work, it is part of our lives and probably links in, for a whole bunch of us in terms of our general interests about things. So thinking about how these things integrate can energize us. So it's not about just saying work lives over here by itself. It can be part of our interest in life. So, for example, I'm interested in psychology because I'm interested in people, and people are part of my everyday life. So these interests kind of spread into my different areas, but there are certain boundaries I still need to keep to be able to keep one thing in its place.
Yeah. Being able to see all the bubbles and know that they're all important. They all play a part in the complete picture.
That's it. And they will change over time. They will change over time too.
Yeah, that's true. So I just, as I'm sort of imagining your bubbles now as well. So I'm imagining some of the bubbles growing and shrinking in size over time as, you know, different things happen in your life and they're all kind of priorities. They're all important. They all have to stay. You don't want any of the bubbles to burst. But,
no, or take over the whole space either.
Yeah, so yeah, even, just one big bubble with everything else swished around the sides.
That's it, that's it. I mean, even over a week we see the bubbles shifting and changing. You know, the work bubble should shrink a little bit when we get to the weekend. Or when we get to the evenings, the work bubble should shrink. And so other bubbles can take their place and kind of build up a bit more space. So, yeah, that's how I kind of like to think about it. It's a bit of a dynamic kind of moving picture.
Yeah, and I think that's probably it, isn't it? It's that dynamic nature of it to realise that all the bubbles, all the pieces will shift and change and move and grow and shrink, and how we can see that as a pattern over the course of a day, over the course of a week, over the course of a year, coming up to Christmas, minds are starting to turn to perhaps Christmas holidays and spending time with family. So the work bubble, I know for me, my work bubble in my mind is starting, well, it's the forefront now because I know there's a lot to get done before Christmas, but there's a time there where that kind of shrinks to the background as summer holidays take over. But then even over the course of a lifetime, that's a lovely way to think about it. I really like that. Melissa, again, another big question, but hopefully just a few little ideas on your part would be just wonderful. What can you offer our listeners in terms of simple things that they can help to maintain their bubbles and create a bit of well-being if work is taking over?
Simple things. Simple things.
I mean, we've talked about boundaries and expectations and managing your tech and those sorts of things.
Yeah, I think they're the most important ones for me. When I think about the simple things, it's often the most obvious things that we forget about when we're stressed and when we're busy. So boundaries, thinking about how we can manage our boundaries, thinking how we can manage our decompression time. So say, for example, an interesting kind of thing that I like to talk to people about is that decompression time, that third space between going from one thing to another, that space between stepping out of the office door and that drive home or that commute home and stepping into your front door. How are you going to use that space? There are interesting ways that we can think about how to use that space in terms of decompression time, listening to podcasts, for example. How do we use that time? How do we create those times for ourselves? Keeping good exercise, keeping good diet, you know, all of those practical things that we've heard a million times before, but find it so hard to implement is something that I would recommend, and thinking about how we can set up good habits and routines about that. But I think most importantly is when do we, you know, how can we actively and intentionally switch on and switch off?
Okay. So that intention piece again.
Yeah, coming back to that intentional.
And noticing, I think, you know, when you were talking then, I remember one of the most difficult times in my working life was when I went back to work after having my first child. And I loved being back at work. I didn't find that difficult at all. I thoroughly enjoyed the stimulation and the people and being able to make myself a cup of tea and sit quietly for a while I you know, looked at some data or whatever it might be. And I also loved being at home. I think it may be a better parent, but it was the travel time in between that I really struggled with. I was living in Sydney. It was not an easy commute. It involved a train and at least one bus, if not two sometimes. And I found that that was where I worried and I stressed, and I felt that I wasn't in that moment. I wasn't doing a good job at work. I wasn't doing a good job at home because I was stuck trying to commute. And for me, once it was, again, the awareness, so becoming aware that that was stressing me out, which required a little bit of paying attention and not just kind of getting embroiled in it. And then we talked earlier about past successes, and I thought, well, what did I used to do, you know, in a previous life when I got stressed or when things got difficult? And I remembered that music was really helpful to me. So I dug out the, you know, this was pre-smartphones. So dug out the iPod and loaded up some music, and I used that as time to just decompress, as you say, and it was very, very helpful, and therefore a strategy that I've continued to use over time. Again, you do get back into the habits of just worrying, but I think that's a wonderful tip.
Yeah, great example.
Yeah, just that decompression. And I know I've talked to people about using that, using the train as an opportunity to, you know, use Smiling Mind or one of the apps to do a bit of meditation or read a novel, you know, get away from the screens altogether, read a novel, paper-based proper book.
Mm.
Yeah. And I like the idea of that decompression term, just being able to use it to decompress from one life, particularly if you're going home into another busy life, a bit of downtime for the brain and the mind.
Yeah. And I often like to talk about active relaxation in terms of those decompression times as well. So active relaxation, again, in terms of doing something intentionally and actively, like reading a book.
Mm.
It takes us, you know, coming back to the neuroscience of it, it takes a very different part of our brain to process that information. We get, you know, we get pulled into the story. We start to actively process the story. We use our imagination. We use a whole bunch of things that we wouldn't use if we're just watching the telly, for example. Mm. Just watching a soap on the telly or a drama.
Mm. So or mindlessly scrolling Facebook.
Or mindlessly scrolling Facebook. That's it. So active relaxation rather than passive relaxation, in the ways that I like to talk about it, can be really, really helpful in terms of that decompression. And we know through research is that it really does help with a true decompression and switching off. Switching the brain into another mode of activity is the idea.
Wonderful. So that's brought us full circle back to the brain stuff that we started talking about at the beginning. Yeah. Melissa, thank you very much for all of the fantastic tips and strategies and ideas and insights that you've given us into how to best deal with stuff that I think we all have to deal with, no matter what work we do or where we work or the type of environment we're working in, or in fact, if we're not working at all, because I know that this is the same kind of stuff that people just deal with in a busy life. So I really appreciate your time and your input. Is there somewhere in particular that people can find you if they want to find you? Where should I send them to have a look and find out more?
Oh, people can check in at the Mind Room, themindroom.com.au, which is a good place to find me.
Excellent. I will pop that in there. I know because we've had your colleague Jo Mitchell on the show as well.
Mm.
She was our inaugural guest. I'll have to get her back on at some stage soon. So over there at themindroom.com.au. Wonderful. Mm. And Jay and I will put together some of the tips and strategies that you've suggested, as well as that link to the Mind Room and any other kind of information things that we've discussed today as background resources so that people can go and thrive and flourish at work and at home.
Wonderful. Thanks. It's been so much fun.
Excellent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So that is a wrap for season 3 and our first year of the Potential Psychology podcast. And I hope you have enjoyed the interviews and episodes as much as the team and I have enjoyed bringing them to you. Thank you so much for being here. You are the reason that we create this show. And if there is even one tiny thing that you have learned from our guests that has helped you this year, I would love to hear about it. You can leave a rating and review on iTunes, and that's super simple if you use the podcast app on an iPhone to listen in. Just search for Potential Psychology, select the podcast, scroll right to the bottom of the page below the list of episodes, and you'll see a little row of stars, and you can rate us using the stars. And if you look a little bit further, you'll see a note that says write a review. Hit that and let me know what you've learned. I'd love to hear it. I read and appreciate every review, and of course I'd love it if you'd hit subscribe while you're there. And to keep in touch over the break, you can subscribe to my regular newsletter. It goes out once every 2 weeks or so, and it's filled with resources, news, links to my favourite TED Talks, special offers, and some behind the scenes here at Potential HQ. You can go to potential.com.au/subscribe. Or go to our homepage at potential.com.au. I've been doing some updates to the website recently, so you might like to have a look at that and let me know what you think. And as always, the links and tips and resources mentioned in this episode can be found at potential.com.au/podcast. And you can stay in touch with me over the break, as I will stay in touch with you using social media. Search for Potential Psychology on Facebook or Instagram, and you'll probably see some holiday snaps, as well as the exciting stuff that I've got happening to get you ready for a fantastic 2019. And if you hang out on LinkedIn, you can find me there too. So I think that's it from me. Thank you again for sharing your time with me this year. If you are holidaying soon, stay safe.
relax, rejuvenate, and reconnect. And I am looking forward to sharing 2019 with you. Have a great break, and I'll see you soon.